The most successful shows came from teams that spliced familiar partners together with new blood. Success comes from compiling a group that includes a degree of both novelty and confidence, dynamism, and familiarity. Jane Jacobs is unquestionably best known for the argument that framed the death and life of great American cities, namely, that neighborhoods, properly crafted, maintain an organic quality of their own. But Jacobs' second book, The Economy of Cities, made a different claim, one that focused more squarely on the issue of creativity. Less than a decade after Arthur Koestler published his treatise on the foundations of innovation, Jacobs came to the remarkable conclusion that the process later termed the Medici effect was in many cases a phenomenon of everyday routines. Having spent hours watching the patterns of life from the stoop of her Greenwich Village brownstone, she discerned that the sorts of interactions that incubate new ideas are suffused through the chance encounters of a well-functioning neighborhood. The Economy of Cities compared the two leading industrial centers of northern England, Birmingham, which in the years following the peak of Britain's industrialization had flourished, and nearby Manchester, which had declined. The crucial distinction, Jacobs concluded, had everything to do with the nature of the businesses that defined each metropolis. Manchester's behemoth manufacturing plants had replaced the winding city streets where smaller firms had once been set in close proximity. Birmingham had retained a critical mass of smaller shops and storefronts. Jacobs acknowledged that the larger textile plants in Manchester were more efficient, but she argued Birmingham had persevered through the textile industry's decline exactly because it had spurned the impulse to cut slack out of its system. However much waste went into maintaining a slew of smaller, sometimes redundant businesses along Birmingham streets, the diversity had allowed it to adapt to the changing tides of Britain's national economy. In the end, Birmingham had benefited by adhering to a less efficient production model. To Jacobs, that suggested something profound. While the inevitable collision of different ideas between small firms may make them less efficient on a day-to-day basis, it allows them to thrive over the long haul. In other words, while the Medici effect flourished in Birmingham at the cost of productivity, it had been bulldozed in Manchester. Whatever edge Manchester had gained through economies of scale, Birmingham's vitality emerged from the dynamism of a nimbler spirit of commerce. Jacobs went on to trace similar dichotomies through contemporary history. She noted, for example, that there would have been no reason before New York emerged as the nation's commercial capital to expect the Big Apple to become more commercially powerful than Jersey City, which was situated just across the Hudson. Both cities sat at the mouth of the same river connecting them to the Erie Canal. Moreover, New Jersey was on the American mainland, making it much easier to reach the vast market of customers living at all points west. The Garden State's expanse offered another selling point. In the largely undeveloped areas farther from the Hudson, a spate of chemical companies chose to set up plants near one another and then build a regional infrastructure unencumbered by the conflicting patterns, schedules, and needs of businesses operating in other sectors of the economy. It appeared more efficient to grow in Jersey. New York had no such advantage, if only because there was no way to avoid the mishmash of overlapping firms and industries. Trucks full of textiles would inevitably get caught behind tourist buses, which themselves would be stuck behind cabs. It was often impossible for booming businesses to expand where they were. Everything was more difficult and invariably more expensive. At first glance, it seems obvious that business would eventually cross the Hudson in favor of the Garden State. As we all know, that's not what happened. New York City has thrived. It has resurrected itself even after periods of epic decay because, in an echo of Birmingham, the rhythms of life and commerce in the Big Apple support long-term adaptability. Businesses glean advantages when they are sited near firms engaged in other sorts of commerce. Proprietors from disconnected industries bump into one another while traversing the narrow island grid. In Jacobs' view, the same chaos that often proved wasteful also incubated new ideas. And in that context, Jacobs coined a term that may be the best description of the Medici effect: valuable inefficiency. Jacobs was arguing that the dynamic Arthur Koestler had identified as the key ingredient to innovate ideas at an individual level, and that Franz Johansson would later apply at the level of an individual business, also applied to the geography of a local neighborhood. She contended that new thinking was generally pollinated when experts from entirely divergent fields collided through the everyday interactions of cosmopolitan routines. So much as we frequently assume that innovation emerges out of some combination of dumb luck, above-average education, and innate intelligence, there's another factor at work: community.
This is an important message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
If you must use a chainsaw,
follow the instructions to be safe. Wear a hard hat,
safety glasses, chaps,
earplugs, thick work gloves,
chaps,
and boots. Always hold the saw at waist level or below and make sure that others remain far away.
If you are cut,
put direct pressure on the wound
to stop bleeding
and get
medical help
as soon as possible. To learn more, call the CDC at 1-800-CDC-INFO.
If you must use a chainsaw,
wear chaps.
All right, that's our public service announcement. We got five minutes and 42 seconds left on this thing. So, played the public service announcement about chainsaw safety because my dad almost got killed by a, he got almost killed by a tree because he wasn't using chainsaw safety, as in, check your escape routes before you saw down the tree. So he slipped and had like an 18-inch tree fall on his leg. Which my brother lifted off from like Hulk style. I remember being there. So yeah, be careful with your chainsaws sawing down trees. But my dad's accident prone. He almost got killed three times in his life. So that tree is being one of them. So be careful sawing down trees. So let's get this finished out. We got like another 5 minutes left, and then I'm up out. I'm not gonna play music afterwards because I didn't. Gonna be too busy tonight, so maybe next week. So this is the last show of the semester. So this was Radio Lyceum with James.
The outstanding question then is how the transformation of American community will affect the dynamism of the nation's economy over the long term. Our hope has to be that the networks that have become the building blocks of American life will make more typical the sorts of cross-cutting interactions that propelled Watson and Crick, Bell Labs and Apple, New York City and Allentown. In the best-case scenario, the outer-ring relationships that have thickened would generate the balance of societal trust and novelty that's so crucial to the broader project of innovation. Unfortunately, the evidence to date hasn't borne that theory out. By several estimates, American innovation has slowed of late, as massive investments in fields like green energy and pharmaceuticals have failed to produce the return that investments in information technology generated just a few decades ago. Some of that analysis, we should note, predates the new development of fracking. George Mason University economist Tyler Cowen recently argued that innovation in the United States has actually stagnated, noting that we've picked the low-hanging fruit of technologies produced by previous generations and are burning through the competitive advantages those breakthroughs bestowed on today's economy. Peter Thiel, a co-founder of PayPal and a powerful figure in the world of venture capital, has sounded a similar alarm, arguing that whatever advances Silicon Valley has spurred of late have been canceled out by America's failure to make progress on other technological and scientific fronts. No fair assessment can blame the stagnation of American innovation entirely on the structure of American community. The Medici effect, as evidenced by Pasteur's discovery of vaccinations alone, is not born only through the sort of cross-cutting relationships found in townships. It can also be driven by efforts within any one field to braid new ideas together. Indeed, there's a compelling argument to be made that the key to innovation in the future will be expanding the universe of people working in a single pocket of research to form a cluster of experts around specialized challenges. But we shouldn't dismiss the role played by the disappearance of the middle rings. The new model of innovation born in networked community is different, in at least one fundamental respect, from the archetype that has long served as a foundation of American ingenuity. In the township communities, a variety of challenges and worldviews were discussed through the course of chance meetings and during the coffee breaks at organized events. They were the fodder for the back and forth at the corner bar, and they were the bridge between people from entirely different walks of life. When he published The Radicalism of the American Revolution in 1993, Gordon Wood looked beyond the explicitly political narrative that defines our understanding of the struggle for independence. George Washington and his peers were unquestionably driven by a desire to free themselves from the tentacles of British monarchy, but that wasn't the whole story. They were also driven to adapt the nation's political framework to the social architecture beneath it. The township architecture of community that had begun to emerge near the end of the 18th century couldn't abide the incumbent system of British rule. And so, the Constitution that was written several years after the Revolution was born to accommodate township community. We may not be on the verge of a revolution today, but we face a similar conundrum. Our political system isn't in rhythm with the network community that replaced the American township. That's not to suggest we should abandon the Constitution. There is a way for American government to adjust. But we ought not to minimize the challenge. In his revelatory work exposing how Facebook and Google are obviating the cross-cutting interactions in American life, a full 30% of Americans get news from Facebook, Eli Pariser put it well. Ultimately, democracy works only if we citizens are capable of thinking beyond our narrow self-interest. But to do so, we need a shared view of the world we cohabit. We need to come into contact with other people's lives and needs and desires. Pariser was focused on technology, but the principle applies across the American experience. Our dwindling faith in American government is apparent in our own front yards. Three factors will determine whether we'll be able to adapt. The first is the extent to which networks continue to subsume townships. The second, as evidenced by the results of deliberative polling, is how capable we are of establishing patterns in network society that reflect the benefit of township familiarity. And the third is our capacity to reform the political system to fit 21st century community. We don't know how things will turn out. Already efforts are being made to develop technologies that might cut neighborly alienation, allowing people who live near one another to use social networks to build bonds. If the federal government can't break the current gridlock, it's likely that local government and nonprofits will emerge to fill the void. So we need not be despondent. But if America is to thrive in the decades to come, recalibrating the relationships between democracy and community will be one of our most trying challenges yet.
So that is the very end of the book. So I think the reason why I chose this book to end it, because it kind of summarized a lot of chunks of stuff that I kind of covered during my show about social capital and innovation that happens around communities, which I covered when I covered Einstein's biography and lots of different things that they covered. I thought it was a nice sum up, and the book is a little bit academic. In my mind, that's a plus. I kind of like people that cite studies and evidence and stuff like that, instead of making stuff up, which I often do. So with that said, why don't we roll out my top four books of the books I kind of covered this semester. This one's on it because I kind of closed with it. I think it's a nice summary of everything. The Vanishing Neighbor. No, this is not a horror story. It's about sociology. The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community by Mark J. Dunkelman. I recommend this book to anyone to go out and check out. Audiobook. It's available in audiobook, obviously, or book. Number two on my list, but probably number one overall, I would say Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. That's by Matthew D. Lieberman. I absolutely love this book. It blew my so many different things, facts and figures and studies and Yes, I'm a nerd. That was, I found fascinating and just illuminating. I really enjoyed this book. We're wrapping up the last show in the semester, the three, four favorite books. Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do by Michael J. Sandel. We covered, just to his Justice series, six episodes we went through. So I really appreciate his, he's been a promoter of expanding our view of how we debate, how we have discussions in public, to kind of bring that back to people. We can effectively bring your points across to how to have respectful debates, people that have different views than you. So I think it's important. I obviously side on more the liberal side of the spectrum. I'm WREV people, and I live in Burlington. That shouldn't surprise you. But I think it's important part. It's a skill you need to exercise if you really want to get your point across. And I think I've had relatively success with when you be respectful and you listen to people, their opinions first, and then ask some questions about their opinions and try to build a bond with the person before you just try to argue them down. And I think, in my opinion, Twitter, now called X, is a bad form to do that. I think it's just too toxic. People can be disrespectful because they're not face-to-face. They're not their neighbors. They're not people they have to deal with daily, like coworkers, and middle social organizations where you have to deal with these people. And you actually get to see people that have those opinions, and not just people online could just paint someone to be like, oh, it's some crazy radical liberal that I disagree with in every shape or form. But if you talk to people in real life, they often have opinion. We have opinions that we agree on all the time. So I think it's important to just have face-to-face conversations. So Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? Absolutely love this book. Also, I believe it is definitely an audiobook as well. If you, like me, are dyslexic and can't reading speed is very slow. And his other stuff is great too. So check out his other books. And of course, I almost made it through the whole episode without talking about Wittgenstein. I'm bringing him at the very end. Philosophical Investigations, Ludwig Wittgenstein. It's a very difficult book to read. There are great lectures on it online if you want talking about his overall view, talk about philosophical investigations. But if you're in philosophy class and you're kind of into this kind of thing, or you're into language, I would highly recommend the book. It's absolutely changed my view on how language works and how you have debates and how important that is. And it's also great for people that are interested in AI. It's basically, I would say, if you want to understand how modern AI works, you read Philosophical Investigations, you understand how it works in general, how language is formed through context and example after example after example. That's how it's built in the human brain. That's how it's built in AI. So I would highly recommend Philosophical Investigations with Ludwig Wittgenstein. That's with a W because he's German, he's Austrian. They spelled W's. It's at your local library. It's at the HAL. I just checked out the book and I had to return it. And I bought a used books online. So you go check that out at your local library. Philosophical Investigations in there. I got fooled when I was reading it. It's in German and English. So I'm flipping through. It's like, what? The left page is German. The right page is English. So I flip through. I'm like, wait, this says this is English and German. My grade school German, I wouldn't be able to read this because I was just flipping, looking at the left page. Put it back, and I'm like, that's got to be. And I looked at, pulled the thing back out again. It's English on the right hand side page. So you check out the book. English is on the right page. German is on the left. But if you can read German better than I can, which is likely, keep that in mind. It's a great book, Philosophical Investigations. So those are my four books. that I'd recommend to go out and read maybe over your summer, or if you're like me, you can do the audiobook version. Philosophical Investigations, because I thought so it was so essential to, I talked about it every freaking show, so I should go out and read it. So I did, so in paperback, and now I have it in paperback, yay, on my bookshelf. And I also have Social, because I liked it so much. So this is the last show of the semester. It is 10:20, so I gotta get up out of here. I'll probably be here next week. I believe it'll be signups. It'll be over throughout the summer, throughout the same time. There will be more interviews involved. I hopefully will be back up at Burlington so I can make some more of those connections, and get some more interviews with people who have organizations that are the mid-tier Mingrung organizations, like Dunkelman was talking about. So anyway, I'll see you guys probably next week. Have fun, go out there and socialize. Out in Burlington, it's a great scene. There's a bunch of different places you can do that. It's great. So we'll play you the end of the Fred P. mix at Lot Radio to close up, so I can wrap up my stuff, and then I'm up out of here. So this has been Radio Lyceum. My name is James. This is WRUV FM Burlington. Oh yeah, and check out Fred Priest's new album. It's great.
What are you doing?